We are in 1 Chronicles, and we are in chapter 11, all right? Freaks me out when people step up on the stage when I don't see them. Just so you know that I am armed and dangerous, okay? Just so you know. So, we are in 1 Chronicles. We made it to chapter 11, okay, the last time. It was like 3 weeks ago. But we came in our study, we remember Chronicles is written kind of, if you will, from God's perspective. And so in this particular passage, it's as God is looking at it in comparison to the book of Kings, which is kind of written from man's perspective. So in the book of the Kings, you see all of the sin and all of the debauchery. And when we get into the Chronicles, it's almost as if, you know, from God's perspective, we're seeing it differently. So some of that stuff is not there. And the reason being, this was written after, you know, when the children of Israel were actually coming back into the land. So a lot of this stuff God has already forgiven. He's already dealt with it. He's already moved on. And so it's an amazing thing how we see all of this happen. In chapter 10, we saw where Saul dies at the end of the reign of King Saul by the hand of, when we talked about this, you know, where he's at war with the Philistines. Philistines wound him. It appears that an Amalekite may have, you know, finished him off, but, you know, Saul tries to kill himself. That doesn't happen. So we studied that a little bit. You know, then David takes over. So David has been made the king. He takes over first in the southern area. He is there for, I think, what is it, like 7 years, I believe, or something of that nature. And then the Jews from the north came down and said, "Hey, David, we want you to be our king." And so they set him up to be king over all of the land of Israel. Now a united kingdom. Everything is now together. And so in this now, we kind of shift gears a little bit and it moves into a different direction. And it tells us about what are these group of men known as the mighty men of David. And so we're going to talk about it, especially in chapter 11, the rest of chapter 11, and then moving into chapter 12, where it talks about the growth of David's army and how that came about. But you got to remember that as this is looking backwards down into the past or into the history of David's life, David, when he was anointed king as a young child, he gets hired on into Saul's household. So he's living in the palace with the king. And David rises up in an amazing way of power. Saul becomes jealous of him because of the fact that David is a mighty warrior. He's a man of great honor, a man of integrity. The girls start singing David's praise. Saul becomes jealous, throws David out of the house. David starts running, and as he does, he takes off because he refuses to kill Saul himself. As he's on the run, God begins to bring men to David. He begins to attract a certain group of men. And we learn that they were men that were in distress, men that were in debt. But they had one thing in common. These were faithful men. And so we get into this little section right here. We've talked about it before, but in order to kind of have some fun with it, we're going to go back and look at where we studied it in the past. But they're known as the mighty men of David. There is what are known as the three. And it gives a reference to three of David's mighty men. Now, they're called the three. What makes you, you know, why do you think they call them the three? Anybody know? There's three of them. Very good class. You guys are good. Then they have another group that is called the 30. Why do you think they call them the 30? Well, there was at least 30 of them, believe it or not. So, in fact, if you do the counting and you add the three on, there was like something like 37 or 38 of them. So the 30 were kind of like known as, you know, the elite of David's men. And so we're going to take a look at these guys. We're going to hop around a little bit to kind of find some more about them. But we also want to rediscover again, because we talked about it in the past, what made these guys noteworthy, that their names are recorded in the Bible for all of us to see, for all of mankind to know. These guys' names are written down because they were known as mighty men. Very cool. Wouldn't it be awesome to see your name written here, guys, and say, you know, this was one of the mighty men, and to know your name was written in that book. That'd be very cool, wouldn't it? And so, let's take a look at some of these guys, you know, that their names are written in the pages of Scripture, and the only reason that their name is written there is because they were a mighty man. But we're going to find out what made them mighty, okay? So we pick it up in verse 10, where we left off the last time. Chapter 11, 1 Chronicles, chapter 11, verse 10. Now, these were the heads of the mighty men whom David had, who strengthened themselves with him in his kingdom with all of Israel, to make him king according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. And this is the number of the mighty men whom David had. And here we have guy number one, Jashobeam, the son of a Hachmonite, chief of the captains. His name written here? He had lifted up his spear against 300 killed by him at one time. So here we see this guy whose name recorded here in the Chronicles is Jashobeam. We learn that he's the son of a Hachmonite, okay? So to find out a little bit more about this guy, let's put your bookmark here, and we're going to flip back to the left to the book of, let's see, where did I put it here? We're going to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 23, okay? 2 Samuel 23, and then we're going to kind of flip back and forth here, okay? So don't lose your spot where we are here in 1 Chronicles, but let's take a look at these guys, okay? It's interesting that here we talk about the three, but he only tells us the names of two. And so back in 2 Samuel, we learned about these guys. So look what it says right here. These are the names. So chapter 23, verse 8. Are you guys there? Okay. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb, Bashibath, the Tachmonite. How would you like to have that mouthful of a name? Now you're looking at it saying, and it says chief among the captains. He was also called Adino the Ezonite, because he was an Italian. Just kidding. Because he killed 800 men at one time. So we have an interesting thing here. Is it a different name? Or is this a different guy? Did he kill 300 or did he kill 800? So this presents an interesting dilemma, doesn't it? Actually, it's not a problem. His name is Josheb Bashibath, or Jashobeam, also called Adino the Ezonite. So his name, actually, he is known by these many different names. So when you look into the Hebrew, the same root is the same part of his name. Just like some people call me Rob, some people call me Robert, some people call me Elron. And so in any ways, I'll answer to any of these, okay? So then comes the next question. Okay, did he kill 800 men or did he kill 300 men? Well, that's a very good and interesting question. The scholars are divided on this. Some say it's just a simple error in translation, that it was an error. And so is it 300 or is it 800? You know what? The honest answer is no one really knows. But what we do know is this dude killed a bunch of people at one time. So The question then remains, did he do it single-handedly with his sword, or did he herd a bunch of guys off of a cliff, or, you know, how did it happen? Was he just like, you know, the Tasmanian devil just swirling around and just, you know, guys were flying all over the place? I don't know. But what we do know is that the Bible tells us that this guy is the number one guy, the main man of David's mighty men. He was the chief because he killed hundreds of guys at one time. It's an amazing thing. Now, what's fascinating right here is that, you know, this particular man is, you know, they change his name to Adino, which is very interesting because it literally means, it's Josheb, Bashabeth, and all of this kind of his name, it literally means the man who sat in the seat. If you look it up in your Bible, you'll see that it says literally one who sits in the seat. Or one who's a driving force. So that's why some people believe that he drove an army, single-handedly drove a group of men backwards to where they literally went off of a cliff. And so this guy, though, is known because, you know, his name literally means Josheb, Bashabeth, or Jashobim, literally means splendor. When you, to look at this guy, you would see that, you know, in war, as a warrior, people looked at him and just said, wow, that guy's amazing. Splendor, just mean to be amazing. And yet, then they change his name to one who sits in the seat or one who's in the driver's seat, one who takes charge and makes things happen. No wonder David records this man's name in the Bible for all of us to see, and no wonder he became the chief among the captains because he was a guy that took the wheel and made things happen. What an awesome thing. That's the kind of man that can be a great leader. One who, you know, David would say, here's what I need to have done, and this guy would say, give me the wheel and let me drive and I'll make it happen. You don't have to worry about this again, David. And that's what made this particular man, Josheb, or Adino, that's what made him one of David's mighty men. So much so that in a single battle, the guy was out there fighting, and everyone called him, wow, his name fits him. That's splendor. That's amazing. That's awesome watching this guy fight. People just went, oh, look at him go. And so this is something that as we look at these different people or these different men, we can look at them and say, okay, well, how can I apply that into my own life? Because my name is not going to ever be written in the pages of Scripture as known as one of David's mighty men. No, but we can still look at these guys and say, that would be someone that I would say, I want to be like that guy. That I would model myself after. And so what character trait do we see about this guy that maybe each one of us in this room could say, that's something I want to model after? And I think that for us to look at it, to say, you know, that in our Christian walk, that it would be something that would be splendor. That people would be able to look at you, that people would be able to look at me and see and say, you know what? That's amazing. In the midst of trial, in the midst of difficulty, in the midst of the battle of life that we go through, when the enemy is attacking, when the world is crushing in, that we would be able to handle it in such a way that people would be able to say, that's pretty amazing. Rather than falling apart, rather than, you know, blaming other people, rather than blaming the past and saying, I'm the victim here. Instead, people would be able to say, you know what? That guy's in it, and he's doing a great job. That woman's in it. That's amazing. So that people would be able to see the splendor of our relationship with the Lord in the battles that we fight in. But also, you know, honestly, in the Christian world and the world that we live in, I think it's an amazing character trait to be able to be to have a task presented to someone and to be able to say, hey, let me have that and I will make it happen. and not to require constant babysitting, because, you know, David doesn't put this guy's name in there. It doesn't say Josheb Bashabeth, because I made him the chief among all the cabinets because I had to babysit this guy every step of the way. He gave him a job, and he looked at it, and he was able to determine what needed to be done, and he took charge, he grabbed the wheel, and he said, let's drive. And I think for us as Christians, that's an amazing character trait to say, you know what, I want to be able to take on the ministry that God has given to me and say, Lord, let me have it. I'm ready to roll with that. That doesn't mean that we say, I don't need you anymore, God. That's not what I'm saying. But to be able to take the ministry, the task, whatever it may be, and be able to move forward with it without requiring constant babysitting from those that may be over us. It's an amazing character trait this guy has. No wonder he was the chief among the three, because there were three. And so, in our Christian life, what an awesome thing that we could look at and say, that's the way I want to be. That's the kind of guy I want to be. Okay, so back over now, 1 Chronicles, and we'll flip back and forth, so don't lose your spot here in 23, okay? After him, verse 12, was Eleazar, the son of, what do you see his name is? Dodo. No wonder this guy was a tough guy. You know what I mean? If somebody came up and said, yeah, your dad's name is Dodo, you know, I mean, that would be a thing to be fighting words for the rest of your life. But he was this guy from the Aoites, or however you pronounce that, who was one of the three mighty men. He was with David at Pasdamim. Now, the Philistines were gathered for battle. It was a piece of ground full of barley. So the people fled from the Philistines, but they stationed themselves in the middle of that field and defended it and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. Okay, so you see, now flip back with me to chapter 23 of 2 Samuel. Let's see about Eleazar again. Verse 9, after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Aoite, one of the three mighty men with David. When they defied the Philistines who were gathered for battle, there for battle, and the men of Israel had retreated, he arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day. The people returned after him only just to plunder. So what made this man a mighty man? Two major things right here that we see. First of all, when others retreated, he went forward. And he began, as he was wielding his sword around, he began to fight so hard that his sword stuck to his hands. We talked about this when we went through this in 2 Samuel. What an awesome thing. For us as Christians, we are living in a world and in a time right now where we can see many in the Christian life retreating, running backwards, hiding, because the battle is getting more and more fierce. We are going to be squeezed more and more into, you know, this little box where they want to try to fit all the Christians, because we don't fit in this world. And it's becoming more and more obvious, isn't it? And so we got to shut these Christians up. And so, you know, let's create laws that shut them up. And either we can retreat as cowards, or we can stand up and say, no, you're not going to shut me up. And the second thing is that we carry in our hands an amazing thing that is, we are told in the book of Galatians, in Hebrews, that this is called the sword of the Spirit. And so one thing that I would love for each of us to have is that we are wielding this thing around in such a way that we are holding it so tightly that it sticks to our hands in the midst of this battle. that we would be known as people of the book. Why? Because it's in your hand. That in the battle that we get in, and in the difficulties that we face, that we would have the sword of the Lord in our hands, and that's what we stick to. And we got to stick to that, you guys. Because the world doesn't want our opinions. The world doesn't really care about how we feel about stuff. They want truth. And this is the source of truth, you see. And so, just as Eleazar was known as a man who, when others retreated, he marched forward, and he was a man that held on to his sword. What an awesome character trait for us as Christians, as a mighty man or a mighty woman of God, that we're saying, you know what, I'm not going to cave in. I'm not going to run backwards. They're not going to tell me I can't say Merry Christmas, for crying out loud. I'm going to say it anyway, and I'm going to be a student of the Word. I'm going to have this Word stuck in my hand so that I know what it says, I know how to use it, and I can be a person that is known as a guy or a woman of the book. An amazing treat that is. And so, we see that after he talks about this great victory, it says, now, in verse 15, back in 1 Chronicles, 3 of the 30 men moves on into a different thing. So I don't want to jump there. Let's go back and let's get our third guy before we move on, okay? Just because I think it's important for us to know what these guys are, okay? So we have Eleazar, the son of Dodo, and now, after him, verse 11, are you back in 2 Samuel 23? Okay, 2 Samuel 23, 11. After him was Shammah, the son of Agi. And so an interesting name, Shammah. And he was of the Hararite. And the Philistines had gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. You guys know what a lentil is? Like a bean, okay? So the people fled from the Philistines. So here's a guy, Shammah, in the midst of a field of beans. The people fled from the Philistines, but he, Shammah, stationed himself in the middle of the field and defended it and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. And so, an interesting thing, what makes this guy such an amazing man that he became one of the three? Isn't that interesting? Well, during this particular time of the Jews, the Philistines would kind of hide up in the mountain areas. They would wait for the Jews, who were experts at planting and you know, growing crops. They still are. They would wait for them to plant the crops, get the produce, and then they would wait sometimes just before they would harvest it or right after they had harvested it. They would come down out of the mountains and raid, and, you know, like just bullies that they were, and take the stuff away from them. And so on one occasion, David said to Shammah, you stay here in the field of beans and guard this, because this is our food, and this is the food of some of our Jewish brothers. So Shammah stays there. All of a sudden, here come the Philistines, just like they anticipated would happen. And Shammah stood in the midst of that field with his sword, fought off the Philistines, and saved this field of beans. And so that's what made him one of the guys that was, you know, one of David's mighty men. And so I find that to be fascinating, a character trait, that here David takes his men and they go off to fight in some other battle somewhere, and they leave Shammah behind. And Shammah could have said, what? Me guard the beans and stay with the women? Let somebody else do that. Why do I got to be the guy to do that? It's just a field of beans. What's the big deal? Let a couple of the kids stay here. But we don't see anywhere at all. In fact, if he would have spoken like that, his name would not be recorded as one of David's mighty men. Because instead, what did he do? He said, all right, this is not a field of beans. This is a field of gold. And I will stay here to protect it because my master has asked me to do it. My king has told me to do this. So he took that job so serious that it didn't. It seemed like a menial task. It seemed like something that was beneath him. But he said, no, I'll defend this with my very life because that's what my king told me to do. So he took the small things that had been given to him and he did it with all of his heart as if it were a field of gold rather than a field of beans. And so it became very important as the guys came back. You know, of course, they needed that, the people that he protected. And so it's an amazing thing that all of us, you know, Jesus even said that, you know, that if we have to handle the small things first before greater things are given to us. And in reality, you know, in all reality, in the eyes of God, let me ask you a question. In the eyes of God, does he see things as greater or lesser? Or does he see it all as great? He sees it all as great. So when God was looking at Shammah, did he look at Shammah and say, it's just a field of beans. Do that and then maybe I'll move you up in the, you know, in the kingdom's work. No. Shammah was known as a mighty man because he protected a field of beans. You see, it was about the issue of the heart. He didn't look at it and complain and say, well, how come I can't do, you know, that? Let somebody else do that. I want a bigger job. I want to be in front of the people. He said, nope, that's what my king said to do. I'm going to do it with all of my heart as unto the Lord. It's an amazing thing. So his obedience and his commitment gained him recognition as one of the top three. And so for me, for you, you guys understand this. We got to get this. We as people look at things and we elevate one position or one task as something that's higher or greater than another task. What? What do you mean? Work in the nursery. That's dumb. Let somebody else do that. I want your job, Rob. I want to be in front of the people. And we elevate that. Well, I want that, man. I want to play the keyboards in front of everyone. And we think that that is greater than running the vacuum after a service. But in God's eyes, it's all the same. What he looks at is the heart, you see. We elevate things or devalue things based upon what we think is important. Clean the bathrooms. What? Let somebody else do that. Can't you hire a laborer for that? But in God's eyes, he says, cleaning the bathroom and playing the keyboard, it's all the same to me. It's all the same because I look at, will you do it with all of your heart as unto me? See, it's an attitude of the heart. Obviously, I want the heart of Shammah that I said, okay, Lord, you want me to protect this field of beans? I'm not going to complain. Here we go. Bring it on. And so, very, very important that for us as Christians, that we look at whatever it is that we do, even for those of us that are, you know, we, you know, you think that ministry is what happens within the confines of a church property. That's not all. This is only one small little fraction of what ministry is. True ministry is what you're going to go do when you get out of here tonight, when you go home and you take care of business at home, when you go to your place of employment tomorrow. How you do that will determine if you're a Shammah or not. How you do your work tomorrow, the attitude of the heart by which you go into your place of work or how you take care of your kids or whatever it is that you do tomorrow will determine whether you're a Shammah, whether you're a mighty man or a mighty mouse. See? So I encourage you, examine, you know, we need to examine our hearts with each thing that we do. It's an amazing thing. So we have the man who sat in the driver's seat. We have a guy that didn't need to be babysat. We have another guy who, instead of retreating, he went forward. His sword stuck to his hand, frozen in his hand. And then we have a guy that was willing to, you know, fight with the same commitment, with the small things that if it were a great thing. And so that's what makes these guys the three mighty men of God. So or of David and of God, literally. So back now to chapter 1 Chronicles 11, back over there again, okay? And let's see what happens next. Now, verse 15, three of the 30 chief men, now this is interesting. This is different than the first, than the three that we just talked about, okay? This is three guys out of this 30 that is known as the 30, okay? Now, three of the 30 chief men went down to the rock of to David, into the cave of Adullam. Now, the cave of Adullam is in Bethlehem. For those of you that have been to Israel with us, you know where Jerusalem is. You know where Bethlehem is. You can kind of get an idea. It's about 12 miles from the from one to the other, okay? And so, and the army, continuing on in verse 15, the army of the Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David said in verse 17 with longing, oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. And so the three broke through the camp of the Philistines. And you know what, you guys, I messed up. Adullam is near Jerusalem, and David was longing for it at Bethlehem. That's the 12 miles in difference, okay? 12 miles away from Bethlehem where this was at. And so, verse 18, the three broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, David would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. And he said, far be it from me, O my God, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of these men who have put their lives in jeopardy? For at risk of their lives they brought it. Therefore he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men. So this is an interesting little scene that takes place. David is in the cave of Adullam. 12 miles away is Bethlehem, where he's longing for this water from this, you know, well that was there in Bethlehem. And it's interesting, when you're away from home, the things that you long for. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of a wild thing. You know, anybody that's from San Diego and they leave here, like our daughter, or literally anywhere else in the United States, really, they leave here. Do you know what the main food that everybody craves when they get back here? In-N-Out, yes, that's one of them. What else? Mexican. That's right, because you can't get Mexican like you can get here in San Diego, right? In fact, our daughter, the first thing she wants when she's coming back is she wants to go get Mexican. And so, but isn't it interesting what you begin to crave? Oh, you know, you could be somewhere and say, oh, man, I'm craving an In-N-Out burger right now. It's a weird thing what you start to crave. Well, David's craving a glass, you know, a cup of water from this place in Bethlehem. So he just pops off, just in it wasn't a command, it wasn't an order that was given, you see. He just, oh, man, I'm craving a cup of water from that, you know, that well over in Bethlehem. So three of his guys get together and say, our king wants water, let's go get him water. What? Are you crazy? It's 12 miles away. Plus, we got to go through the Philistines are out there. We got to sneak through the enemy lines to get this. I'm good. Three guys say, let's go. So off they run. You know, all kinds of stealth work as they're crawling through. 12 miles one way, you guys. Walking. Running. They get this, you know, cup. They bring it back to David. Here you go, David. There, you know, be gone all night. Here you go, buddy. David said, what's this? He said, some water from, you know, the well in Bethlehem, like you asked for last night. Could you imagine? David looked into the cup, and he didn't see water. He saw blood. Sometimes it seems like David said, I don't want it. That's not what he did at all. David looked at that and he said, what did you guys do? Well, we went and got it for you. David said, are you serious? You went to Bethlehem? Yes. Well, what about the Philistines are there? We made it past the enemy. We snuck past them. And we snuck past them coming back. You guys just walked 24 miles through enemy territory to bring me a cup of water? Are you guys crazy? No. Why did they do it? We love you. David, we love you, man. And so David looked at that, and he says, I can't drink this, because you know what? You guys, if you went, thanks. You know, the whole army knew what these three guys did. So if David would just, thanks, you guys are awesome. Everybody would have thought, those guys risked their lives for a cup of water? And David just tossed it down? Instead, David looked at that and said, I'm not worthy of that kind of honor, you guys. And so what he did is he didn't just pour it out. You see, during the time of the tabernacle, there was such a thing as a drink offering, where you would bring water. First of all, you would offer a sacrifice. It would be consumed on the altar. And then, you would bring a cup of juice or a cup of water, and it would be poured out. So these always went together. You couldn't just bring the drink offering by itself. And so it was a symbol of, first of all, a sacrifice to take care of the sin. The drink offering represented a life that had been poured out. You get the picture. So here David recognized these guys put their lives on the line, and so now it's only fitting that a drink offering be done. And here he is in the cave of Adullam. This is all taking place in a cave. The rest of the army is watching David honor these men as they had honored David. So he pours it out and he says, "This, you guys risked your life, so the sacrifice was given. Now I'm offering this to the Lord as your three lives that have been poured out for me." So this was David honoring these three men, valuating, if you will, placing value upon their sacrifice that they made for him. David was acknowledging the amazing love that they had for him. You get the picture now. And so this is an amazing thing for you and for me. And we look at that and say, okay, well, all right, but what's the big deal here? Listen, David is merely a type or a picture of Jesus himself. So David was their king. Jesus is our king. We are warriors in this thing called the battle for souls. And I look at that, and as I understand this and as I look at this picture, it's quite convicting, actually. Because what am I willing to do for my king? What am I willing to risk? What am I willing to put on the line? How about you? I mean, sometimes, you know, I would have probably heard David say, oh man, I could sure go for a glass of water from the well of Bethlehem. Sorry, dude. That's 12 miles away. And it's cold tonight. Besides that, there's Philistines out there. Sorry, David. You're going thirsty tonight, bro. And yet, in the kingdom, you know, what am I? Am I willing to risk? Am I willing to put out the effort to show the love and the adoration for my king? That's a convicting thing to read when you put it in that context, isn't it? That when we contemplate how far are we willing to go for Jesus himself? How does our love, how does our devotion, how is it seen? Are we willing to take ridicule? Are we willing to take, you know, people not liking us? People not inviting us to their little parties because they know how we are, right? Sometimes, I just can't handle that. You know, no way, that's not going to happen. Are we willing to put our time on the line? Well, wait a minute, Rob. I mean, I know I should. I know devotions are a way that I show my love for the Lord, but do you realize I would have to get up at 4:30 in the morning for me to be able to pull this off? Do you see what I'm saying? We can look at this and see, wow, what am I willing to put on the line for my King? I leave it for you. I leave it for me. Well, then we move on to another guy. This is very interesting. Look what it says in verse 20. Abishai. So here we see another, he moves on to, you know, some other men that are noteworthy. Abishai. Now, notice who he is. He's the brother of Joab. He was chief of another three. He had lifted up his spear against 300 men, killed them, and won a name among these three. Of the three, he was more honored than the other two men. Therefore, he became their captain. However, he did not attain to the first three. So who is Abishai? Abishai is David's nephew, if you remember, his sister's kid. And he's the brother of Joab, we are told right here. And so, believe it or not, he became a very, very close friend of David. Not only was he his nephew, but he was also a very close friend. In fact, David took him on several noteworthy expeditions. Remember the time that David snuck into the camp of Saul and everyone was sleeping? And so he had Abishai with him. And that was when, you know, he picked up, the thing, his spear or his sword. And Abishai says, let me kill him right now. I'll put a spear right through his heart. He won't even be able to get up. So he was a rowdy little guy. David says, no, we didn't come here to kill him. What are you, crazy? And so Abishai was with David on that particular journey. And, he went with David when he left. You remember the story after Absalom came in and his rebellion, and David was departing from Jerusalem. And remember the guy named Shimei that was standing up there, hey, David, you loser, yeah, kicking dirt on him. Remember that whole story? It was Abishai that said, let me go up there, cut that dude's head off right now. So he was always quick with the sword, but David made him one of his chief guys. He was, became one of his closest companions. Look, verse 22. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. Now, this guy is amazing. Check this out. He was the son of a valiant man from Kabzeel who had done many deeds. So he had killed two lion-like heroes of Moab, so two men that were very strong, great prowess. And he also had gone down and killed a lion. So this is kind of an interesting little digression. I mean, it's like, well, could be worse. There's a lion. Yeah? Well, Benaiah, would you go kill it? Huh? Could be worse. Well, how could it be any worse? Well, he's in the midst of a pit. Okay, well, that's bad. But it could be worse. Could be snowing. Well, by the way, Benaiah, it's snowing. And so verse 23, and he killed an Egyptian, a man of great height, 5 cubits tall. In the Egyptian's hand there was a spear like a weaver's beam. And he went down to him with a staff, wrested the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, did. And he won a name among the three mighty men. So this guy is a warrior. Now, obviously, just the things that he did make him noteworthy. Do you want to know something very interesting? This guy was in the lineage of Aaron. His father, Jehoiada, was a priest. So he's the son of a priest in the lineage of the priesthood. So this guy could have been a priest. So literally, he was a priest if he would have wanted to go that direction. And yet, what direction did he choose? He chose to be a warrior instead of to follow in the lineage of the priesthood. Now, to be a priest would have been an awesome privilege, would have been an amazing opportunity for him. He could have continued on in the lineage of Aaron, but here we see a priest that became a warrior, and a mighty warrior at that. So it's an interesting picture of a guy that chose a different direction, and believe it or not, he is the only man recorded in the Bible who was a priest that instead became a warrior. We have priests that became prophets, but never a priest that said, no, I'm going to be a warrior instead. I'm going to go ahead and join the military and follow that particular direction. And so this particular guy, you know, he became a soldier. He rose to, you know, the position of, you know, David's captain over his bodyguard. So what an awesome thing. To where this man probably looked at his life and he says, you know, I could go down this particular path and I could be a priest, and that would have been an honorable thing for him to do. But he probably looked at his gifts and his talents and he said, you know, I think I'd make a better soldier than I would a priest. And so amazingly enough, God honored that in this particular man. He didn't say, whoa, time out. Benaiah, you're a priest. You go to the priest school and you follow your daddy's, you know, direction. And so here we see, amazingly enough, that this guy said, I'd make a better soldier. And so he followed that passion and God blessed him. He was able to kill lions and, you know, on a snowy day in the middle of a pit, you know, he jumped down into the pit, bang, you know, he even kills a giant just like David did. And so what an awesome picture of a guy saying, I'm looking at the gifts, I'm looking at the talents that God has given me, and I know I could be a priest, but I want to be a soldier, man. And he followed his dream. And he followed his gifting, really. And so, an amazing thing, by the way, he also, at the death of David, followed into Solomon's court and continued to be faithful even to Solomon. So the guy lived a long life. He was awesome even in his older age. So now, we move quickly into verse 26. Also, the mighty warriors were Asahel. And look at all of these different names that I am no way going to try and pronounce, okay? Look at verse 27, Shemoth. Look at all of these names. Do you see them all? Verse 33, Asmaveth. Elihaba, you see all these guys' names. Verse 35, Ahim. Verse 39, Zelek. All of these men's names, we don't know anything about them, amazingly enough, except for one thing. Why are their names written there? They're mighty men. These men were known for their valor, for their character, and but I want to draw your attention to one interesting name. Look at verse 41. Uriah the Hittite. And then it goes on. His name is in the midst of many different names. Goes on to verse 42. Dina, and it goes on and on and on. Lists the rest of these names. And in the middle of that little section is Uriah the Hittite. That to me is almost heart-stopping. Because you guys know who Uriah the Hittite is? The wife or the husband of Bathsheba. And so Bathsheba, as you may remember, a beautiful woman, for whatever reason, she was taking a sponge bath on a roof in the line of sight of the king. Okay, David's standing out there drooling. And, you know, her story is told. You can jot this down next to verse 41, 2 Samuel 11. But you may remember the whole story. And this shows you the kind of man that Uriah the Hittite was. And why is his name different than all the rest of these guys? I find it fascinating. Well, A, he had a beautiful wife. Okay? B, just happened to be a beautiful wife that David saw checked her out, moved in on her, and he got her pregnant. Now, this is what's fascinating. He calls Joab, has Joab send Uriah home. David's trying to fix this mess he got himself into with his own human effort. Instead of just repenting and asking God what to do, David says, I got to fix this. This chick's pregnant. She's the wife of one of my guys that is known as one of David's mighty men. David calls Uriah in. You remember this story? This is what makes him a mighty man. He brings him home. David says, buddy, hey, good to see you, man. How's it going out there in the battle? Oh, it's a tough one. He says, well, here's the deal. You got the night off. Go home. Sleep with your wife. Take a good hot shower. Eat a warm meal. And just enjoy yourself tonight. You got the night off. You remember what Uriah does? He goes out to the outer edge of the king's palace and sleeps on the floor. He doesn't do it. David hears about it, calls him back in. Uriah, what are you doing? How come you didn't go home? And he goes, King, my men and the rest of my buddies are out there sleeping in the battlefield. They're sleeping on the dirt. How could I go in and sleep with my wife? Mighty man. Character. David says, all right, go. You eat dinner with me tonight, night two. David has some alcoholic beverages brought in, gets Uriah drunk. He says, all right, bro, go home now tonight. She's all your. He still doesn't go home. So David finds out about that. He says, what am I going to do with this guy? He's not going to go home and sleep with his wife so that we can say, ah, the kid's his. We fixed my mess. Mighty man, character, honor. So then finally, what does David do? He writes his death warrant, says, Joab, I want you to put this guy in the front of the battle. When the battle is fierce, withdraw your men, but don't tell him. David does this. Uriah gets killed. But what makes him a mighty man is the character that he displays when the king, who's supposed to be a man of character, turns out that this man has more character than David does at this point in David's life. David's making a blunder. He's trying to correct it without going to God. This shows why Uriah was an amazing man of God. If that would not have been said, we wouldn't know anything about the rest of these men. But one thing we do know about these men is they were probably just like Uriah the Hittite. They were just like him. Great men of character, great men of honor. Men that said their yes was yes, their no was no. They knew that they were in a battle and it's an amazing picture of what a man of character really looks like. You see? And so it's a fascinating picture that we see right here. Now, I want to draw your attention to one quick thing, and then we're going to close. Who was the leader of... I've mentioned his name several times. Who was the leader of David's army for most of David's life? Anybody know? Joab. Isn't it interesting? His name is missing from the list except for one little incident where it talks about Abishai in verse 20, and it says, Abishai, the brother of Joab. But in the list of the mighty men, Joab's name is not listed here. Isn't that interesting? So I looked at that and I go, wow, that's interesting. Wonder why. Well, you guys may remember, Joab was kind of a man that was he kind of rebelled against David on several different occasions. He's the one that killed Absalom, ran him through. But where Joab made his huge mistake, remember when at the tail end of David's life, he's lying sick in bed. And at that particular point in time, David has... His son, he had promised the kingdom to Absalom. But as in this particular section, we see him with Adonijah, David's other son, who seeks to take the kingdom before his dad's even dead. He tries to take the kingdom, sets himself up, does a big feast, and Joab gets in on that action. So Joab looking out for himself, which is some things that he had done for much of his career, even though he was a valiant warrior. He loved David, but in the final days of David's life, he defected to Adonijah instead of going to David and saying, David, who have you chosen? He had watched David fluctuate. He watched the mess with Absalom and all this kind of stuff. But instead of being faithful to the end in the Adonijah thing, he went over with Adonijah thinking, you know what, I'll set this kid up and I'll get me a good spot in the kingdom to come. And then David hears about this. And that's when he tells Solomon, you know, remember Bathsheba comes in and says, hey, didn't you tell Solomon? Yeah, I did. Well, did you know that Adonijah's kind of setting himself up to be king and Joab's with him? David says, oh. So Solomon takes over the kingdom, you know, and that whole thing is established. And then one of the first guys that gets axed is Joab because his heart had drifted towards the end. So it's interesting. Why is his name not mentioned here? It appears because he didn't finish well. He started, he went through the whole thing, but he didn't finish the race. What a drag. And so, an interesting thing for us to kind of keep in mind. Mari was telling me she's reading out of her one-year Bible, for those of you guys that are reading out of it. She was reading in Revelation 2:17 today. And did you guys know that there will come a day where we're going to be handed a little white stone, and on that white stone is our name, a new name that no one else knows. Except for you, we're going to know it. When you get it, you go, what's my name? But you know who knows it? God knows, because he's the one who wrote your name. So did you know that he has a name for each one of us that someday we're going to get it handed to us on a white stone? I don't know what all the symbolism of all that means. But one thing I do know is that we just read through a bunch of names here that we don't know who they are, but God knows who they are. And he knows their character. And he knows what makes them special. And he knows what makes them mighty men. And he has a name for you that maybe nobody else in the whole world's going to know, but God knows your name because you're special. And that he loves you. And that it's a very, very special name that he has just for you. Did you know, I looked it up, David's name in one context or another in the New King James Version is written 1,018 times in the Bible. Did you know that? Isn't that interesting? David's name over 1,000 times written throughout the pages of Scripture. These dudes right here, most of them, one time their name is mentioned. But I think it was good enough because God knows who they are. Even though David's 1,000 times, God knows who David is. We all know who David is. We don't know who some of these dudes are. I couldn't even pronounce their name. Didn't want to. Right? We skipped them. That's how unimportant they are in the grand scheme of things. But God knows their name and he wrote them here. And your name is written on a little white stone. But you know what's even more important than that? Your name has been written in the Lamb's Book of Life. That someday we're going to enter into the kingdom of heaven. He's going to get out that book and he's going to say, let's see, Elron. Oh, he's not, listen, my name is Rob. And he already knows my name. An amazing privilege to have your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. God, we thank you for tonight. We thank you for these names. But Lord, they're just names that represent amazing men of character. And I pray, God, that as we look at these different ones, that we would see examples for us to follow. Examples, Lord, for us to look at and to emulate. That we might see you as our King and just consider how far are we willing to go. Make us those men and women of character. Make us those men and women of honor that we might honor you, the King of Kings. Bless us this night, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.